جوای بنیاد مطالعات ایران مصاحبه با منصور فرحانی 20 دسامبر 1990 نیویورک مصاحبه کننده مهناز افغانی.
The commission went to Iran in March, and they were supposed to be there only for 5 days. And the agreement, as it was in early January, that supposedly the agreement remained the same, except that it didn't materialize because of American opposition to the formation of the commission. They were supposed to release the report and also get the commitment that the hostages would be released. And Khomeini refused to answer them after 5 days. And he said the next day, which was very uncharacteristic. So for 17 days, these people waited in Iran. And finally, the Khomeini said no. And by this time, the Iranian political scene was very sharply and intensely divided between those who wanted to release the hostages and those who didn't. And Khomeini finally took the side of the hardliners. The commission returned from Iran empty-handed, and I immediately submitted my resignation. I don't know if there was ever any official, I was officially introduced to the UN and all that, but I had never received anything. But nevertheless, I submitted my resignation in writing and returned to Foreign Ministry. Wabzadeh continued to be, and he said, and I said, this is absurd. And during this entire period, I never went inside the UN building as a delegate of to the General Assembly or any committee as a delegate of Iran. I used to go to the parking lot, take the elevator and go to Waldheim's office, and go down to the garage downstairs and get out, simply because I thought, you know, representing a country that is taking hostages is kind of absurd and degrading. So we didn't really do, we had absolutely nothing to do except this thing, and also massive requests for interviews and commentaries and so forth. And once in a while, I accepted an invitation and always presented a case, but trying to remain more or less credible to the pro-Khomeini people who were watching, and at the same time trying to present a kind of a civil view of Iran and the hostage crisis.
Were
hoping
you reporting to Iran regularly?
Absolutely. There was no reporting. There was on the phone talking to that. Here, suppose I was very much into, after Banisadr became, in February actually, and that was another reason that made my stay here kind of interesting. I went to Geneva as the head of the Iranian delegation to the Human Rights Commission, which was very interesting, and I really enjoyed that. I was very active on behalf of the Palestinians. The Argentinians at the time were there. That's where actually I met in Soheda. That was a very learning, interesting experience for me in the Human Rights Commission.
When was
it? It was in February in 1980.
Of course.
It was the hostage situation. This was the real challenge. Fortunately, it wasn't presented to, it wasn't discussed, but informally it was present. Except that everybody could understand. We were there for about 3 weeks through formal statements, presentations, and informal contact and communication that the hostage taking in Iran was not something that all political forces supported it, the division. Some members of this delegation were there, for example, the French lawyer. I continued to be active and trying to pursue with the Algerian mission I was in contact. you know, these were the situation. On the one hand, you cannot take a position against those who are holding the hostages in a decisive way, because if you do that, then you wouldn't be able. It's the kind of compromise that when you're in that position, you have to make if you want to be there. You want to make a decisive, categoric, adequate decision to disassociate yourself. That's obviously an option, but I have decided to be involved and make the necessary compromises for that period of time in the expectation of being successful. It didn't work out, it didn't pan out, and I resigned. But my entire diplomatic career was 5 months. So I resigned in April and returned to Iran a month later.
How did you feel during this period? I mean, what was the mood?
I was still hopeful, but every single day was a chipping away from the hope. You know, when you begin an experience with a great deal of hope and optimism, and in experience, you know, the reality is disillusioning. It's a process. It was the process of disillusionment. And when I returned to Iran, even during the 5 months, the situation was so drastically changed that I actually started writing political commentary. I was writing in Manisad's newspaper, very critical material, once or twice a week, kind of criticizing all kinds of issues. And that's how we became targeted as the enemy, that when Banisad was ousted, they went, you know, after us. But I, you know, it's a different story going to what happened to in Iran during the period. Individuals were transformed, the institutions were transformed, the leaders were, you know, transformed. I don't have, my view of politics is not that people go into a situation with a well-defined and clear positions and views of what they want to do. I think we all go into these situations with, knowingly or otherwise, with a great deal of malleability, vulnerability, flexibility. Even if we don't have it, we will inevitably be faced with decisions or choices that involve these attributes. Now, if we are not the type, we could easily disassociate ourselves and become a sideline. But if we decide to remain in that context, that's... So, from Khomeini down to the Revolutionary Guard, I would say they had the same, you know. Giving you an example of when I talk about the Guard, it doesn't really have anything to do with my experiences, but it symbolizes something interesting. One hostage, Charles Quinn, who was released earlier because of his illness, several months before the rest of the report, he wrote a book called Inside and Out. In that book, there is one interesting sentence which was really made the reading of the book worth the time. He's starting to guard in the middle of the night to the person who is guarding him. A revolutionary guard, he has a gun and all that, and he knows some English. And this guard asks Charles, and he says, when you're free and go to the States, can you get me an acceptance from an American university so that I can go there and study engineering in another year to study? I don't know if this Revolutionary Guard was aware of this incredible contradiction in his head, you know, about the university, you know, and all that. But I think it symbolizes about the, you know, as many American officials, the same people who used to be very critical of the United States and all that, but when they see the counselor privately, they want to get a visa.
Now, when you went back, you say you saw changes. What kind of changes? In terms of people, how have they changed?
on one level, positions were being opened up, professional bureaucratic in the positions, and I knew a good number of people who were involved in the anti-Shah movement abroad, and then they moved into various bureaucracies with the idealistic or professional interest of taking a position. So the individuals were faced with submitting to religious authority and becoming a professional bureaucratic appointee of a reasonably high level, from the minister on down. A good number of these people, perhaps the vast majority of them, made those compromises, because what was very clear from the very beginning, that the religious people were not opposed. Khomeini and Beheshti and Rafsanjani and the rest were not at all interested in expelling the liberal, non-religious forces from the crowd at all. They were interested in making them submit unconditionally and without hesitation to their superior authority. They used to say that we will control the majority of umur and you will be the mujri. It was a very clear choice. What you did at home and the way you lived your life didn't particularly concern them. So it was interesting to watch a lot of people being faced with that decision and making the choice. I would say here, giving you a good example, there are right now two individuals in New York, Kamal Kharrazi and Sadiq Tehrani. They have the rank of the ambassadors. They were both very close to Bazargan and Yazdi. So at some point early in the game, they found themselves in the position of whether following Bazargan and continuing the descent or becoming part of the Jamhuriya. The vast majority of the people who were with Bazargan, particularly on a younger level, they deserted Bazargan. And still they constitute a very significant, perhaps the majority, of the professional bureaucratic positions of the regime up to the present time. Disintegration of the left was another development that was kind of shocking, that they were empty, they were dogmatism that we are talking about from the governmental position was far more intense and vicious among the left. And because there was more idealism among the left in a philosophical sense, and they had no responsibility, there was no relationship between the way they lived their lives and their security and so forth and the ideas they were propagating. In fact, they were more susceptible to dogmatism and uncompromising kind of positions. That in a sense, this infatuation with international movements and international ideas, whether it was Maoism or Castroism or Andalusism or Stalinism and all that, they were crumbling before your eyes. And again, these characters I knew personally, the many of them friends, the same age or a few years younger, that they had been active abroad. And so many of them really lost their lives, literally hundreds of these people. I can sit and really think about the names of the people that I knew as a student, and later on they found themselves before the Farc, squads. Another very important and revealing and disappointing thing I learned during this period, that the intensity and the passion was gone, and some reflectiveness had taken its place, and a more sober view of what was happening, was the emptiness of liberalism. That these individuals who were our heroes because of their association with Mossadegh, that they turned out to be extremely incompetent and empty. really disconnected from the base of the Iranian society. To me, at least, that was another, because I identified with those people in my, you know, political life and interests more than any other, you know, group. That, you know, my idealization of big names who had inherited the mantle of Mossadegh was as unrealistic, as naive, as disconnected from the realities of Iran as the idealism of the left with respect to Maoism when it comes to leadership and all that. But the idealism of the liberal religionist about Khomeini and all that. It's, that was another, you know, stark type of confrontation with reality. So, you know, there were daily, you know, occurrences. So this reflection was, at least as a teacher, I would say it was a tremendous learning experience now that I survived.
Did you see Bazargan during that period?
Yes, I saw Bazargan quite, you know, regularly. And he remained, you know, morally he remained unshaken. For these people, they were always suspicious of mullahs in general, but this was the first time that this suspicion was very real and it had been actualized. And I would say for men like Bazargan, this recognition, this the suffering of humiliation in the hands of the clerical elements was extremely painful on existential, personal level, and somewhat shocking on a political level. Again, I go back to my personal experience. After the 53 coup, I was a high school kind of student. We used to go on Friday nights to Masjid Hidayat, because Bazargan, Talibani, used to speak there. He was the Pesh Namaz, the Friday prayer leader of Masjid. And at that time, Bazargan was teaching in the university. They had an association of Anjuman Muhandisin Islami, the Islamic Engineers Association. And they used to come to this, to the Friday night gatherings at the mosque to take part in the prayer, and we never went for the prayer, but after that, Taliban space, and it's really a nostalgic gathering of pro-Mossadegh forces in the mosque. And many of them had never been to a mosque before. But what I remember very distinctly was that for the clerical elements, for mullahs, associating with men like Bazargan and Sahabi was an incredible source of prestige, self-importance. And they were treated from that period, from 53, to the eve of Khomeini's return to Iran. These people were treated with immense respect and admiration, because it was through these people that a lot of clerical elements made connection with the middle class and gained respect. So gradually, men like, you know, Bazargan and Sahabi, and even the younger ones like Yazdi and Chamran, Sabbaghian and so forth, Mointal, they were all in the same, you know, crowd, part of the same association. They had come to kind of expect the clerical elements to treat them with respect and deference, you know, but they were just accustomed to it for all these years. That picture suddenly changed. It went through a very drastic kind of change, that they were being dismissed and disrespected, even threatened with arrest and so forth. They are still probably in the shock, but in those immediately, when it began, liberal religion has had a very tough time to adapt, to adjust to this change of attitude on the part of the clerics. I remember talking to Bazargan when he was in the hospital. I went to visit him and all that. This was one point he made. He made, we never thought that these people would treat us with such, you know, disgust and nastiness, and dismiss us so easily. He said, I could never anticipate and imagine.
And then, what did you decide to
return? I remained politically active, writing, going to still the universities. Mizan was being published, was I remember. I wrote some articles for Mizan, Inqilab-e Islami I wrote. When I returned to Iran, the first thing I did was I wrote a long letter, about 12, 13 pages, about the hostage crisis. It was, I issued it as an open letter to members of parliament. And I explained my view of the hostage taking, fundamentally that how it is damaging in Iran. And not only that, that was one part of the letter, and how the hostage taking is changing and transforming American politics in the interest of right-wing Republican militarists. These were the 2 points of the letter. Well, later I learned that I was far more, it was an intuitive observation, but today I have absolutely no doubt that Reagan-Bush campaign team had a connivance with Ayatollah Khomeini and the West not to resolve the hostage taking until November 1980 election. But that is not anything that I could even imagine in my wildest dreams at the time.
It's a,
oh, absolutely. There was absolutely, it's not the kind of thing that, you know, there was a massive amount of writing and investigation even in the Congress, like journalism, academic. It's not the kind of case that one could prove. At least not yet. Someone is, you know, I'll tell you later that someone is actually working, you know, that someone with, you know, credibility has been involved in investigating it for 2.5 years and would issue a book, you know, on the subject. But not at the time. Not at the time. So I wrote this letter, I took the letter to Kayhan. Yazdi was still in charge of Kayhan. So these people were not out yet. Yazdi and Shahriyar Rouhani were running Kayhan. Mahmoud Da'i and Shams Al Ahmad were in Ittila'at. Shams, and I knew Shams from the time I was 14 and 15 years old. At the age of 14 and 15, I was as a part of the student movement under Mossadegh. I was a member of Nirusevam, and Shams Al Ahmad was our Sohangui Hose. You know, they had structured the party along the line of what they knew about the Tudeh party. And later on, I worked with Jalal on his translation of Andre Gide's Return from USSR. I was in charge of getting Al Ahmad's writing and taking it to the printer, which at the time I cherished the experience simply because I used to go to Jalal's house and just see him. It was, you know, so I knew the family and I knew Shams and all. So I, with this letter, I went to Yazdi. And Yazdi read it and sat on it for 2 weeks. He was kind of interested in working with me and other, and he didn't want to say no, and he didn't dare to publish, because he was already under attack. From there, I took it to Ittila'at. I talked to Shams, and I talked to Da'i. They sat on it. You know, Da'i was even opposed to the idea, what Shams did. They sat on it, and they finally said no. So I went to vernissage. He wasn't even in. He was, there was anarchy. He didn't listen. So there were two editors. One of them was very interested. One of them was not. And the day that the other editor was in, he was out of town. Jalal Mousavi was the liberal editor. He knew some of the students who studied in France and other. He published it. And then I actually, with the help of the Inqilab-e Islami and Jalal, I reproduced that thing, made 200 copies, and mailed it to members of the Iranian parliament. It was just an act that I thought I should report this experience to. But it was the only, and then the Tehran Times translated part of it and, you know, published just the news. It was longer. So after that, I continued along the same line, but becoming increasingly critical. And Inqilab-e Islami was a platform, and it was an anarchy there, which is entirely a different story. Vernissage is the only Muslim anarchist I have ever known. So it depends on who was in charge. When you read Inqilab-e Islami of the period, you find all kinds of stuff. You find the kind of material in it that Hezbollahis could write. You also find Asma'i Said Javadi. You also find people who are very liberal and leftist. It's a conglomeration of various views in it. So I wrote, and also wrote for Mizan, some articles. And the university faculty were still active. They had organizations, small groups. I spoken to this on foreign policy issues and all. So there was a degree of activism going on in our homes. Asfar Jawadi was kind of also active in this. Until the war broke out. When the war broke out, Vernissage decided to use the war, and which was, you know, as a way of consolidating it, because he was being undermined, and, you know, from, I would say, Shahrivar, September 1980, Vernissage took a very open position against Khomeini in his famous presentation. He said, you know, Imam and I do not agree on all issues, you know, and this was the first time, to my knowledge, that someone in Iran had actually said that, and it was true. So from then on, Vernissage became kind of de facto symbol of opposition to this expanding, you know, religious kind of movement. All kinds of political forces gradually, people who completely disagreed with Vernissage and all that, but all kinds of liberal forces congregated. But once again in this situation, when conflict between Vernissage and Khomeini Beheshti, Hizb-e-Jumhuri Islami, developed, the left unanimously took the side of Khomeini and all that, and they treated Vernissage the same way they had treated Bazargan, that he is a liberal, and theoretically, ultimately, he is the antithesis of of the thesis and all that. You know, a kind of static, frozen, almost idiotic way of looking at the world, which was completely ahistorical and unempirical. So this is what they did, you know. This situation until the war broke out. When the war broke out, Vernissage asked me to join him as a member of his negotiating team, because immediately after the war, the United Nations Islamic Conference and the non-allied movement formed mediating commissions. And when they were coming to Iran to talk, so when they come to Iran, they have to talk to the president and all that. So Vernissage asked me to join him in these, you know, efforts, and I did. And after the war, there was a kind of, for a very short period of time, a subsiding of internal, you know, differences because of the occupation of the country and so on. So from late September, early October 1980, I got involved in negotiation with these international commissions as an envoy of Vernissage. When they came to Iran, and also I went to Europe in January and February. And again, largely in vain. We were asking during this entire period, we were asking for simultaneous ceasefire and withdrawal of Iraqi troops from Iran, with all these three commissions. And here I also, it was another learning experience for me, because when these commissions came to Iran, they had to meet with the revolutionary council. And in the Revolutionary Council, that it was really the actual, the Revolutionary Council was at this time really abolished, but with the entire representatives of the Iranian government, and Khomeini sent his men, Majlis sent their men from the military for Air Force and Navy and the ground forces as well as the Foreign Ministry of Iran. So there were about, the Iranian delegation were summing up 15 of them, and the most important team of mediation that came to Iran was the Islamic Peace Conference, representing 12 presidents and prime ministers, Ziaul Haq and the prime minister of Turkey and Sekou Touré